You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of March, 2018, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Daniel Bache. On today's show...
With a year to go, people are coming back together and looking forward. They want us to get on with it, and that's what we're going to do.
The ubiquitous Brexit countdown clocks are being seen everywhere today, and they show 1 year to go. But why does it seem like the work to do should last much longer? My guests Florence Biederman and Ivor Gaber will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Emmanuel Macron's plans for a new French Revolution, this time at the forefront of artificial intelligence. Then another exit from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. But as the Veteran Affairs Secretary leaves, the person taking his job is raising a few eyebrows. Plus, why some in America want to make you feel guilty about buying a new copy of Cosmopolitan magazine. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Daniel Bache. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Florence Biederman, AFP's London Bureau Chief, and Ivor Gaber, a professor of political journalism at the University of Sussex. Welcome both. This exact day next year is meant to be the UK's very last inside the European Union, or at least if all goes according to plan. Despite the lack of progress, the Brexit countdown clock perhaps underscores how little time there is left to get many things done. Ivor, we'll start with you. Article 50 triggered a year ago today. Looking back at the 29th of March 2017, has the debate on where the UK and the EU are going moved at all?
It has, but not in directions that perhaps many of us anticipated. Let me, I won't say correct you, but suggest that next year isn't really Brexit Day in the sense that for all intents and purposes, we're going to be feel like we're in the EU until the transition period, which ends in 2020, is upon us. So it's going to be a damp squid. I know people like Jacob Rees-Mogg will probably be stripping to his underwear in Trafalgar Square and supping champagne. Horrible thought, that. But anyway... It's going to be an odd anniversary, but I have to say that the way that negotiations have gone have not been predictable. For example, I won't go on too long, but if you looked at that roadblock we had, there were three issues we didn't even get to the starting gate because of the Irish border question still unresolved, the fee that we're going to pay, which is now much closer to what the EU required than the UK was going to suggest, and the issue of the domain, the European Court of Justice, will it continue to have the rights over UK law? I don't think any of us anticipated those as major issues they became. We're now in a sort of peace, phony peace in a sense, because we're now waiting for the substantive issues to trade negotiations to begin. And how they're going to go, whether they'll be finished by, according to Monsieur Barnier, it must be finished by October, or whether it's going to be another 20 years, just depends on whose prediction you believe. So the answer to any question about Brexit, but I won't repeat this, but I'll just say it once, is I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, there seems to be some widespread acceptance, even if we don't know how it's going to go, that this is now happening. Is there a clear narrative on how this will go down? Either of you, Florence?
Well, I mean, from an European perspective, I mean, it's bound to be a kind of a failure. It's like a country shooting in its own foot, as Tony Blair repeated again today. So I would say whatever the results, and there will be one, and I tend to think that there will be a compromise or compromises on both sides in the end. There will be a result. It won't be one that will really be favorable for the country. I mean, because we live in such a globalized world that to think that going on your own and making your own battle on your own in this world, be it commercially, diplomatically, as the Russian spy story showed recently, is not really a good idea.
Theresa May loves to say things like stronger, good deal, bright future, and she gives us a sense that Britain will get what it wants out of this, perhaps. There is a narrative here in the British press, a massive list of things to agree on, but what is the narrative outside of Britain, in Europe, in Brussels, say?
for Brussels, it's much easier than for the UK. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have been saying from the start what matters for us and what matters like in for the big countries in Europe, like Germany and France, is that we preserve our system, we preserve our club, and we won't budge on this. So the idea that Britain will go and cherry pick what it wants, the idea of a special relationship, yes, the principle, yeah, on the principle, yes, but on the technicalities, it seems, and the European leaders have been going on repeating that Great Britain has some delusions about it. It seems it will be probably not the result that is expected here.
Ivor, please jump in here.
Yeah, well, in the interests of balance, dare I say, I will try and make the alternative case. And if I don't do it very well, that's for obvious reasons. But in a world, a globalised world, there are so many opportunities that Britain will be able to seize, particularly looking at large markets like China or India, or the United States for that matter, that we are constrained to some extent by membership of the EU, that this is just the right time for Britain to launch out. I can't even believe it as I'm saying it, but I will carry on. This is the theory, but let me now be serious, because I don't believe that for one moment. But I will be serious for a moment. I was listening to one of the so-called Brexit ministers on the radio this morning, Liam Fox, and he kept speaking passionately about taking back control. And there is something almost visceral about this sense, because Britain has never been what we call communautaire. Britain has never felt a sense of being part of Europe for one reason or another. And there is a sort of sense that liberation. Now, I personally think it's phony liberation, but I have to recognise it's a very real feeling amongst many of those people who voted to leave. So there is something there, and I think it behoves us to recognise it, even if, as Florence suggests, economically it ain't going to be a success story.
Mm-hmm. I was, before we came on, I was just listening to the Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, saying a year on, there's still no answers to very basic questions, however. Concerns about environment, agriculture, justice, healthcare, among other things, they'll have to be hammered out as well. So, as you say, perhaps there's a sense of that being taken away, not of liberation in the other way.
There are certain areas as well where one can see a possible gain in fisheries, for example. The UK fishing industry has long felt that European countries took far more fish from traditional fishing grounds than they gave. The common agricultural policy does not benefit the UK. We don't have a large agricultural sector as in France or Germany. So I think to that extent, there might be some small gains. Funnily enough, Florence mentioned the Russian spy issue. I think the government was shown, given the solidarity from not just from the EU but wider, the government's going to use that to show, look, our international influence is not diminished by our leaving the EU. Whether that is the case or not remains to be seen. But I think we have to recognise, even though the arguments against Britain leaving us are very strong, there is some people on the other side of the argument who hold genuinely strong beliefs based on a certain amount of rationality.
As I have two experts rooted in the field of journalism in the studio, I guess we should ask about the narrative in the media and how it's contributing to the debate, perhaps. You see headlines today, things like, why is Brexit taking so long? And Florence, before we came on, we were joking about you and I, me as a Canadian, a little bit confused about everything that's going on. And then when you click over to the BBC's website, they have, you know, they have a quiz. And if you click on cherry pick or hard Brexit or soft Brexit, it gives you a simple explanation, but it seems we're all maybe a little bit confused. How much does the media play a role in straightening out some of these issues for us?
Well, to me, I mean, I see it from a bit from outside being French, but there are really clearly two camps, like the one that are against Brexit and the one that are for Brexit. Everybody knows who they are, especially some tabloids. So, I mean, there is a very different vision, a very different interpretation of the story in those two camps. But it has been the case since the beginning, and the country is divided. The medias are divided. Everybody is very clearly divided. And what is more striking is that nobody is changing its mind. I mean, there are regularly some polls, like, and I'm asked regularly, like when I go back to France, but don't the Brits realize that they made a mistake? Don't they regret? And no, there is no regret. So it seems people knew exactly what they voted for in the end, much more than... So even if there is a confusion, there are some big principles. I've already mentioned one of it, like this belief that is it's kind of freeing of the shackles of bureaucracy, administration, etc. So I think it's pretty clear. How it will happen, what will be technically the results after that, is kind of detailed in a way at that stage.
But I do think, listening to what you're saying, is that Brexit does represent a deeper divide, and almost Brexit was almost the excuse, this culture divide we're talking about, between what you might call people with a more internationalist approach, more tolerant. I mean, London, for example, and the big cities are overwhelmingly in favour of in favour of Remain. We saw the same, I would argue, with Trump. Trump was, if you like, the excuse. Trump was the anguished cry of people who feel that their interests have not been centre stage. And similarly, the people who voted for Brexit, they voted against the establishment as they saw it, despite the fact that some of the establishment were on their side. And I think we've got to recognise that in the UK and the US, and I'm thinking whether we saw the same in France with the relative success of Marine Le Pen. We see it across Europe, in Italy, the success of in the recent elections, in Germany with the rise of AFP. This divide is now a major factor, and Brexit was the unfortunate casualty, if you like, but it wasn't necessarily the cause.
I want to cross the channel to France now, where earlier today President Emmanuel Macron announced that the country will invest 1.5 billion euros in artificial intelligence. That's up to 2022. The measures are intended to compete with the U.S. and China in that sector and to attract more researchers to the country. Florence, I'll start with you here. The president has a lot on his plate right now. Why is a new AI strategy a focus today?
I think I heard the word revolution in the announcement about this. Well, I wouldn't say it was a revolution because 1.5 billion euros is not that much an amount. I think what Macron is trying to do, I mean, it's to change a certain culture, certain mentalities in France. It's part of all these reforms he's doing, like to make it more, a better environment for free enterprise, for initiative. And I would say that's in this context that you have to see this AI initiative. But it's true also like that France is late compared with, of course, United States and China, who is not, by the way, and even compared with other European countries, including Great Britain. So there is an effort to be made, but it would be progressive. It's not such a colossal effort.
Yeah, Macron said he aims to reverse what he called 30 years of underperformance on innovation, saying the country missed all the big tech revolutions in recent years. Is the goal to make Paris a new Silicon Valley? Are they really that far behind, Ivor?
Well, it's interesting that Macron mentions 30 years, because I was always struck when I went to France in the 80s, they had this thing called Minitel, and this was a revolution. France was ahead of the game. Before the World Wide Web, France had established a system in almost every home of little computers directly linked to the phone that provided a range of services. And we were all incredibly impressed. And the system actually lasted until very recently. But it was obviously... But I think, and this comes back to the point, the question, France never really exported this technology. It trickled into Belgium. But it never exported it. And I thought this was odd because here the French technologists, scientists have developed for the first time a really groundbreaking, 1982, long time before the internet or the World Wide Web. And yet it wasn't really exploited to make France a world leader. And I think there's an interesting cultural issue there of why not, because it certainly wasn't a technological lag. And I think what Macron is doing is looking back at that. I don't know whether Florence agrees, and saying, you know, we have the ability, we haven't been doing it.
Part of it, yes, is the environment, the bureaucracy. I mean, this is the reason that we're quoted by the guy who wrote a report about this, like for the government. The lack of, the low salaries for the researchers. I mean, there is a series of reasons, because many French goes abroad, go and work in United States. Some of them are even a leader in Facebook. I mean, in some companies they have really high postings. So the idea is how you keep these people, how you attract them, which is also the case, like, for all these young people you have in finance here in London. I mean, it's not only for artificial intelligence. That's why I was saying it's in the context of let's try to to create a different environment, a more modern environment, more business friendly.
And that can trickle down into so many other sectors, perhaps. Macron also citing today the country is sort of a treasure trove of data, if you will, and the country being in the EU has strict data protection laws. Are they enough? And with everything that's been going on, Cambridge Analytica comes to mind. What's the coverage been like so far about privacy? Florence, has that played a role at all?
Of course, it will be at the center of also of this evolution in France. Like, apart from all the question of how to attract business, etc., there is one which is about the ethics, about the protection of data. You mentioned Cambridge Analytica. Everybody realizes now that, I mean, data is kind of a trove. Data is the new oil, it was said at the time. It's a term that you don't hear that much anymore those days. You know, big data is not used that anymore. It's more like artificial intelligence, but it's covering the same topic. Like, you have these millions and millions of data that are accessible. There is no real protection of this data. I mean, everybody a bit smart can access them and use them, and you definitely need protection for the individual, for also the companies and for the institution. I mean, one of the trend that Macron wants to in the data wants to install in the artificial intelligence is on health, on transport, so on defense. So it's kind of public sectors that really matters to the people. But then you will have to have very strict barrier on the exploitation of these data.
I thought it was very interesting that Macron said we've got this fantastic resource that because we've got this huge public sector, we've got all of this public sector data under one roof, so to speak, that other countries, including the UK and the US, haven't got. And it would be interesting to see, absolutely, and particularly when it comes to health issues, how well it can be protected.
Other centralisation, yes, will play a role, and with guarantees. And again, that was put as one terms of the debate when Macron presented his plan. It's a real concern.
Certainly, it will be interesting to watch in the years to come. We're going to take a short break now. Coming up next, from all the people President Donald Trump has a personal relationship with, can you guess which of them has now joined the White House?
The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns for a fourth year, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tech-sharp panelists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality. Whether you're an architect, city maker, retailer, media mogul, or chef, pick up a ticket and be part of the debate on upping quality of life across the board. This year, there will also be a special focus on entrepreneurship and making it in the city. We'll be diving headlong into all Zurich has to offer, from fine food, Swiss wine and river swims, to private tours of the best shops and ateliers. So why not join us from the 28th to the 30th of June? Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House, still with me, Florence Biederman and Ivor Gaber. Let's turn our gaze to the United States now, where there has been yet another person fired from the Trump White House. Yesterday, the president announced that he would be replacing his Veterans Affairs Secretary, David Skulkin, with Ronnie Jackson, who currently serves as his physician. First things first, this is second outing in 1 month. Is there a sense that this is a quiet week for the administration?
We're soon going to see a headline which says, nobody sacked at the White House today. But we haven't yet seen that. I mean, I do think there are two issues here. One is obviously the revolving door at the White House. It is, you know, it's extremely worrying that the most important country in the world, as it still is in terms of power, and the most important person seems completely incapable of managing his top team. He either chooses the wrong guy or falls out with them, or they walk. That's one issue. And of course, the other issue is an ethical issue about his, you know, his personal physician and bringing him in as a member of his cabinet. Does he carry on being the personal physician? Is there a conflict of interest? What knowledge does he have that maybe, because he did do a very strange thing of going into the White House press room and doing a press conference about the president's state of health, unprecedented. Although having said that, he was Obama's personal physician as well. Yeah. But I mean, the whole thing is... Oh, I was going to say the whole thing is odd. No, the whole thing is exactly as we'd expect from a Trump White House.
There's reports quoting a White House official saying that Skulkin was no longer effective in his role in Veterans Affairs and that distractions were getting in the way of carrying out the president's agenda. Well, his new national security advisor, John Bolton, seems to be sort of the definition of distraction. What do we make of that? What does Trump mean by distraction? Everything in the White House is distraction these days.
Someone he doesn't like anymore for reasons which can be also, I think, personal. Just of personal opposition to him or just because there are bad headlines or... And I think there is kind of a statistic that has been made by an institute, like 40% of the White House personnel has changed within 14 months, like, which is really, as you say, revolving door to a level that was never seen. What is really striking also is that the way he manages team, if any other manager in the world would do this, I mean, he would be fired. I mean, like sending tweets and firing Tillerson, and he's not even not aware of it. I mean, no manager in any kind of training about how to manage a team, you would have such advice. So it's the unpredictability, and it's always worrying. It can be funny, but it's really worrying.
I do think this reflects the fact that if we believe Wolf's book on Fire and Fury, that Trump never expected to be elected the president, so his transition team wasn't in place. He made no arrangements virtually. You know, normally a presidential candidate, when it's getting closer, has already lined up his major appointments. Trump had to make it up on the spot and obviously got it badly wrong and is still making it up on the spot. I mean, what's extraordinary to me is that he still, in terms of public opinion, his base remains solid. You know, the people who voted for him still think he's doing a good job, which I find baffling. But nonetheless, it does seem it doesn't matter what you do, as long as you give people the right impression that he's our Donald, he's a good old boy, he's socking it to them. Crazy, but that's all. But just to come back to the series, but the Veterans Administration is a very emotional position. Mm-hmm. In America, they do give their veterans, they do put their veterans on a pedestal more than most countries do. I mean, we all have war veterans. But it's a very high profile appointment. And this is a man without any political experience he's appointed. I think it's a risk, another risk, and I just wonder how long he'll stay in office.
Do you think you mentioned there that perhaps the Trump team wasn't ready to come into the White House, and now that people seem to be leaving in this revolving door of a sense, whenever they displease Mr. Trump, are they now playing a little bit of catch up, trying to, you know, a Fox News commentator then gets a high profile job? He's just throwing people in. Is that how this is working?
I think he's essentially making it up as he goes along. The problem is I think presidents need, Mrs. Thatcher once said every prime minister, she was referring to a cabinet minister called Willie Whitelaw. So she had the unfortunate quote of every prime minister needs a Willie. But there was a serious point. Every prime minister needs somebody to lean on, somebody dependable. Mm-hmm. Now, bizarrely, Mr. Trump seemed to think Steve Bannon was that man. But once he went, he seemed to have nobody he can fall back on to say, what do you think? No sounding board. Mm-hmm. His daughter, his son-in-law were doing that for a while, that they got discredited. And I think he's alone and making crazy decisions because he hasn't got anybody. I mean, you mentioned the appointment of Bolton. I have to say that scares me. Here is a man who's probably going to try and undo the Iran nuclear deal. He's probably going to try and block Trump talking to North Korea. I mean, this man's track record when he was doing a similar, when he was the UN representative for the United States during the Bush era, was a positive menace. And I'm really concerned at his appointment. And I just think it shows Donald Trump shooting from the hip, which is he stuck in trade.
So just lastly here, Florence, maybe who do we think is next? Who's out the door and who in Trump's world could be in the White House next?
Yeah, there is still a pattern in it. Like, it's more and more ideologues, people with extreme ideas. Mm-hmm. I agree with what Arrow said. He was not ready to be president, and he was not coming from the political world either. So it's not that he had friends or people he could trust that were part of this world. So he has in kind of way to improvise, but the improvisation is going more and more towards not extreme right, but, you know, yeah, Bannon was already in that environment. But the latest appointment go rather in this direction of very, very neoconservative ideas. So in the end, yes, who will come next? I don't know. The one that were under the Obama administration, I think the veteran affairs minister was the last. So let's see.
Perhaps, as Ivor suggests, along the narrative of those without experience may work for Trump's base because he's just carrying on with his agenda, doesn't know really where
he's
going.
Well, it's this idea of outsiders, but actually, you know, we're cleaning up the swamp.
Sure.
We're going to be outsiders. But actually, none of them are outsiders. They're all Washington insiders. That's the irony. The only outsider is Trump.
Seems that way. Well, we shall see who is next indeed. I want to make sure we get our last topic in here today. A conservative lobby group in the U.S. is celebrating after Walmart agreed to pull Cosmopolitan from checkout displays across the 5,000-plus stores stateside. Walmart citing the move as strictly a business decision, but nonetheless, the executive director of the National Center on Sexual Exploitation, Don Hawkins, said, "This is what real change looks like in our hashtag MeToo culture." The magazine will be moved to other shelves in the store in most cases, but the campaign was launched in 2015 with help from Victoria Hearst. She's the granddaughter of William Randolph Hearst, who founded Cosmopolitan's publisher. Are we all following this? Magazine sales continue to decline in many markets, and it's been suggested Cosmopolitan sales at Walmart were likely following that trend, but the retailer has historically been swayed easily by these pressure groups. What's the more likely narrative, do you think, Florence?
Apart from Cosmopolitan, you can think that any other review now with kind of charming ladies or whoever you call them with the sexy headlines or cover will be linked to the Me Too campaign. And this is what I find really a bit embarrassing in the story. Like, is it really at the same level? I mean, are you going to see people who for their own goals, and the association you mentioned is kind of a special one, like very, very puritanic, are they going to use their own goals and take this into the Me Too campaign? I mean, there is really something very different between her sexual harassment and the fact to have kind of a reviewer talking about sex and with the word sex on the front page.
I think it was almost inevitable that the Me Too campaign would slide into puritanism, which is what we see here. I understand the arguments, but it does get worryingly close to censorship. And was it inevitable? I don't know, but it's certainly aspects. And I remember in France there was discussion about there were certainly influential voices in France that were saying enough with Me Too. And I think this was a predictable path it would take.
Is this then a form of censorship, as you mentioned, and does it then set a precedent for other magazines who are struggling to keep up, Florence?
Well, I was just going to make one quick observation, yeah. Cynical observation, if you like, but I remember the editor of one magazine telling me that if he put a attractive woman on the cover, irrespective of the contents, sales always went up compared to having an attractive man or flowers or anything else. And that does seem to be a fact of life. Attractive women attract sales from both men and women.
Imagine The Sun without the page two. I mean,
three.
So, I mean, if you start to apply this principle to the press generally, maybe it will die. Maybe it won't sell anymore. No, I mean, many of the tabloids like Bild in Germany, who is the most sold newspapers, it has changed a little bit, but the page two also was a nearly naked woman. So it has always worked. And what are you going to do now? Consider that it's sexual harassment, that it's contempt for women. So it's the line, as you say, the line between puritanism, real sexual harassment, censorship is really also cultural. It seems in America it always got a bit further than in other countries, in European countries.
Do you feel offended when you see pictures of naked or near-naked women on magazines or newspapers?
I got used to it. I would say when I was not used. I think you have to get used to it. It's a difficult question. For me too, personally, the line is not always that clear, you know.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there for today. Fascinating stuff I'm sure we could carry on with all evening. That is it for today's show. Florence Biederman and Ivor Gaber, thank you so much for joining us here at Midori House. Today's show produced by Carlotta Rabella, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Amber Roberts. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next, and then at 1900 hours, it is The Urbanist. And more on the day's top stories on the Monocle Daily. That's at 2200 London time. Midori House, back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'm Daniel Bache. Goodbye.